OUA playoffs. Their journey to the Yates Cup begins on Saturday, October 25th at home against the McMaster Marauders, and the stakes have never been higher. In the playoffs, the margin for error is razor thin. One play can make all the difference between elation,
a touchdown for the Gales,
and devastation. CFRC's coverage begins at 12:45 with the Grad Club pregame show ahead of the scheduled 1 p.m. kickoff. It's all or nothing, and you can't afford to miss it.
Beats has put it away!
Hey, this is Cleo, and I hope you folks will join me Tuesdays at 5 for my new show, All Tunes. From punk rock to folk, we got it all. Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM. See you Tuesday.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, October 24th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is made possible through the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Today's episode dives into Kingston's spooky side as Halloween draws near. We'll take a walk through the city's growing Witches Walk coming up this evening in support of Kingston Interval House. Meet the curators behind the Creepy Doll Museum, making its Kingston debut at the Broom Factory this weekend, and climb aboard the SS Keewatin for a haunting Halloween night at sea. Grab your broomsticks and summon your coven. The Witch's Walk returns this evening, Friday, October 24th, in support of Kingston Interval House. Witch's Walks take place in cities across Ontario, encouraging witches to don their best pointy hats and show up for local causes. The Kingston Coven took flight in 2023, and they've been perfecting their craft ever since. Founder of the Kingston chapter and beloved local drag performer, Tiffany Morgan, sat down with CFRC to share what the Witch's Walk is all about, where the magic began, and how the spooky season seance has grown over the past 3 years. For people who have not heard of it before, I was wondering if you could just describe what the Witch's Walk is all about.
Well, the Witches Walk, which is, there are Witches Walks across North America, but the Kingston Witches Walk, so it's a time to get, you know, done up, dressed up in your finest witchy attire, gather around, and we do also do a little dancing as well, and, you know, just raising spirits and funds for a local women's charity, and of course, it's not a religious gathering, although anyone of any religious faith can join us as well. We have a lot of people of the Wiccan faith who join us as well, but anyone who's even non-religious and stuff, but yeah, it's just an opportunity to gather around, just, you know, be in the moment of dressing up in your best kind of witchy attire and raising some funds.
Awesome. And how did it all start? I was wondering if you could kind of paint the picture of that first walk.
Well, yeah, that first walk. I was really nervous. People are reminding me of that first year because I had the idea to try to host our own Kingston Witches Walk here in town. And I put out a Facebook event, and I think we had like 1,000 people say that they were interested. And I was like, wait, what? Am I going to have 1,000 people show up? And I got together a little organizing group with the Supreme Witches, as we call ourselves. And yeah, it was a really well attended event. And we raised some really great money for a local women's charity. There was a lot of stress because we're like, this is our first event. What did we have to do? Did we have to do, any kind of like, bookings of venues or anything like that. No, you can just get together and go for a walk. That's quite okay. There's quite a few people who showed up. Definitely over 100 people showed up. We had little witches too. People were like, oh, we're going to have it's a birthday party. Can all these little girls come dressed up? And I'm like, yes, of course they can come. And they enjoyed the walk too. And yeah.
Yeah. When was the first one?
This is our third year. So it was only 3 years ago, which is hard to believe.
Yeah. And this year you had like the market and all these other events kind of leading up to it. I was wondering if you could speak to how it's kind of grown over these 3 years.
It has grown over these 3 years. So once we got comfortable doing the actual event itself, we're like, hey, you know what? I feel like we're already, this is going to be our third year. We're like, we're old hats at this point. So we're like, let's try to add some more complexity to it. So we're like, it'd be nice to do a witch market as well, part of our fundraising efforts. And when I say witch market, because people are like, what are you talking about, a witch market? I'm like, anything witchy that you find at a market. That's, if it's crystals, candles, books, jewelry, whatever. You can find that at a witch market. So we decided that we'll add that to our little repertoire of fundraising. And we hosted it. Of course, the Broom Factory were knocking on our doors when they heard that we were trying to organize a witch market, because they're like, we want a witch market here at the Broom Factory. And that's exactly what we did. So we hosted a witch market at the Broom Factory on Thanksgiving weekend, on the Saturday. And all I can say is that we're going to have to do it again, because it was huge. It was huge. We had vendors who were saying this was their second largest event. And when they said that their first largest event was Queen's University Move-In, that it was a really big event.
At the root of the walk is its cause, supporting Kingston Interval House, a local agency that provides 24-hour safe emergency shelter, community-based counseling services, and second-stage housing to women, youth, and children who've experienced violence. Kingston Interval House has been serving the community for 50 years. And alongside all the fun, I was wondering if you could just speak to the importance of supporting Kingston Interval House and, having a cause tied to this event.
That was always from day one that I'm like, if we're going to have a witch's walk, we need to support a women's charity, because as we all probably know in our history books, that the witches were the women who were supporting other women. And they were the midwives, they were the local apothecaries and whatnot. And of course, they were also the first ones stuck to the stake, sort of thing. So, it's supporting women. Women supporting women, really, is the importance. And Interval House is a it's not all 100% women's charity. It's for women with kids as well too, fleeing domestic abuse. But also, yeah, I feel like it's a really good tie. And it's really great that Interval House, they were able to also be part of the market. And they'll be part of the walk, too. There will be a table, and they will be accepting donations as well. So physical donations, so like toiletries, combs, elastic band, like a whole lot of things that they need to help support the people that they're supporting as well. So feel free to, if you want to know what kind of things that they need, you can visit our website, KingstonWitchesWalk.ca, and we have a listing of things that they need.
This year, Kingston attendees can expect to be enchanted with spells of a witching dance demo from Napanee's Cauldron Sisters and a moonlit stroll through downtown. Tiffany shared what's in store for this year's event.
I'm looking forward to this Friday, October 24th. We're going to do the Witch's Walk. We're going to be gathering at 5 o'clock at Skeleton Park. We'll do some games. We'll have a little opening spell, and then we'll go for our little walk into downtown Kingston, you know, scaring all the muggles. That's the fun thing, too, is like when you're walking down Princess Street in a gathering of, and on the sidewalks. It's not a parade. This is an actual walk on the sidewalks and stuff. It's people walk out and they're like, what's going on? Like all these pointy hats all over the place, all these brooms. And the Cauldron Sisters are friends from Napanee. They do the dance quite often as well. It's going to be lots of fun. I hope people can come out.
With no shortage of haunted history and a natural Halloween flair, it's no surprise the Kingston chapter has cast such a strong spell on the community.
You know, I think Kingston's got a little bit of that kind of Halloween aesthetic. It's funny because most of the Supreme Witches, 3 out of 4 of us, are October babies.
Me too.
There's something about it. Yeah, exactly. You know, a town where the Haunted Walk of Kingston has been going on for like decades and still going on strong. We have Fort Fry. We have all these lovely little kind of spooky kind of like, you know, eerie sort of kind of events and stuff. And I feel like Kingston's got that kind of spooky vibes, you know?
Though the tradition is still young in Kingston, the first 2 years have already been memorable ones.
I think the moments was, the first year we gathered at the end of the walk for a group photo, and that is just the huge group of people who were there doing the group photo. Because I'm, as an event coordinator, I'm sure you know that you're like, oh, sometimes things don't really pan out, and then you know this first walk, it was like such a huge success. So just thinking about that, and then also the market. I honestly didn't know if people would show up or not. And they came in droves. We opened at 9. We already had 5 people at the door at 9 o'clock, and it didn't stop till then. So yeah, lots of great memories with that. And with all my Supreme Witches too, as organizers. So, and I'm really looking forward to the future. We have great plans for the future.
And Tiffany and the Supremes hope the coven will only continue to grow in the years to come.
Well, I'm hoping we build this witch community. Like, I'm hoping that we can become this huge destination for people, you know, just loving to get up, get together, dress up and whatnot, and raise some funds, you know.
Kingston will have some creepy visitors this weekend in the lead up to Halloween, with the Creepy Doll Museum making a stop at the Broom Factory. After 6 years of sold-out shows in Peterborough, Toronto, Ottawa, and Prince Edward County, the Creepy Doll Museum is bringing its collection of nearly 200 dolls to Kingston for the first time. Creepy Doll curators Catherine Behun and Ben Hatcher, the pair who started it all 6 years ago, shared with CFRC how the collection began and grew into a touring museum. Well, to start us off, for those who haven't met you guys, I'm wondering if you'd like to introduce yourselves and share a bit about how the Creepy Doll Museum all began.
Sure. My name is Catherine Behun.
And I'm Ben Hatcher, and we are the co-curators of the Creepy Doll Museum, which, as far as we know, is the first and only Creepy Doll Museum in the world.
I'll share how it started. So I was at a yard sale in Peterborough that's known as like this whole street yard sale, and someone was selling their doll collection, parts of their doll collection. And I bought a few for myself that I thought were very enchanting looking, which translates to be creepy. Big foreheads, frosted eyes, and things like that. And it was Ben's birthday that weekend as well. So I thought, I'm going to get one for Ben and bring it to him for his birthday. He loved it, obviously, the creepiness. Then we just, every time we ran into each other at social settings, we just kind of joke about the creepy dolls. And anytime I go thrifting, I would continue to buy these creepy, unloved dolls with cracked skin and clouded eyes. And it just sort of, we're not sure who came up with the idea, actually, but somehow the idea was born. And
I think that it got to a point where either somebody who just had a lot of creepy dolls in her house, or we did something cool with it and turned it into an event. And we did the latter, and it worked out really well.
And when you guys started, did you ever imagine you'd be getting to the point where you're going on tour with it and doing all this stuff?
No. The first time we did it, we did put a lot of work into the first event, but honestly, we thought we'd be lucky if we got 20 people showing up.
Yeah,
to come see it.
Our goal the first year was like, hopefully we get enough money, like enough profit to go out for a drink at the end of the event. And now this is year 7, and everywhere we go, there's huge lineups. We always have to check, like, what's the fire capacity in this venue? And people really, really love it. And so do we.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is going to be your first visit to Kingston. What made you guys choose to venture all the way out here?
We've done, so the first couple of years was just Peterborough, and then COVID hit. And then once COVID ended, we're like, we want this, like, we want to really like re-enter this with a bang. So we went to Toronto, we went to Prince Edward County, we went to Ottawa. And I don't know, Kingston was just the next sort of largest city within a decent drive of us. And I've got some good friends there who have been bugging me to bring the collection down that way. And yeah, here we are.
Lucky them.
Catherine and Ben explained how their collection has grown to nearly 200 dolls from across Canada, each with its own backstory. And you mentioned there some of the traits you look for when you're searching for dolls or when receiving dolls. I was wondering, from a curator perspective, how do you choose your dolls?
You can go first on this one.
Sure. I'm looking for dolls that I know that nobody else is going to want. So they tend to be older dolls. Like I said, cracked skin, maybe they have, like, for some reason, an extra large forehead because their hair has been pulled out. Cloudy eyes, eyes that are blinking, not in unison. And definitely anything that freaks me out, I'm buying.
And for me, I like the ones that are maybe strange materials. So a lot of the dolls we have are handmade, probably 1800s. So they're stuffed with straw. They're made with burlap sacks. Their eyes are buttons that are kind of falling off. And it is really, I just like looking at things and being like, wow, 100 years ago, people thought this was cute. And it is actually horrifying. But I mean, you know, the Great Depression, cholera, there was all kinds of issues in the world, World War I and II, you know, so many people's ideas of what was horrifying was a bit different than they are now. But most of our dolls now, we don't have to look for. Since the very first year we did it, we got an incredible amount of media attention. And since then, people have reached out to us from all over Canada. I think we've received dolls from every province in Canada saying things like, oh, my grandmother passed away. This was her childhood doll. I don't want it in the house because it is horrifying, but I feel guilty getting rid of it. And if I bury it in the backyard, I'm worried it might come back to eat me or something like that. So it's a lot of people who are handing off items that belong to people they loved. And what I really love about a lot of the creepy dolls that we receive is hearing the stories of the dolls themselves or the previous owners of the dolls.
And do both of you have a favorite story or a favorite doll that you'd like to share?
I have a few favorites. Yeah, I'd say one of my favorites is Mortimer. He was the first one that caught my attention at that yard sale. He sort of resembles Jack Nicholson in doll form. He's got this huge forehead and this sort of sneaky grin.
And I don't really like to say I have a favorite because the dolls do listen and we are worried, you know, there's a lot of vanity and jealousy in the dolls, so they might come back to haunt me. But I do love the stories. And so for each doll that goes on display, each doll has an individualized biography that was written by a different Ontario author. So there's little fictional backstories for every single one of our dolls. And some of them are really spooky. Some of them are hilarious. Some of them are just plain weird and funny. But the dolls are great, but the dolls combined with the stories for me is really what really kind of brings them to life.
And it's not just the dolls who have stories to tell. Visitors to the museum tend to leave with a few of their own.
One thing that I really do love about the show, too, is how social it often becomes. So people come and I don't want to say it becomes a party, but people linger because it's just storytelling in a lot of ways. And then every single person that walks through the museum, as they're leaving, we ask them, please vote for your favorite doll. Like, which doll was your favorite? And everybody has one and everybody has put so much thought into it. And then Catherine and I have a running tally of like which doll got the most votes at any given event. And every doll that gets the most votes earns itself a bright red sash that Catherine sews.
Yeah.
So anyone who comes, if they're wondering why some dolls are wearing red sashes, it's those dolls were voted best in show.
For most of the year, the dolls live with Catherine in her home in Peterborough. So far, she and Ben say they've been mostly safe from hauntings.
So the dolls live in my house year round. So there's well over 200 dolls. Some are on display. Some are tucked away in their hiding places like they like to be. And I have not noticed any paranormal experiences, but I think that's mostly because I treat them really well. They're happy in my house. Some of them have real place of honor. And yeah, I think if they were unhappy, they would let me know for sure.
And I have not had any paranormal experiences. But when I first moved to Peterborough, the house had a deep freeze in the basement. It was an old, creepy, you know, 1800s serial killer style basement. And in the deep freeze was a plastic bag. And in the plastic bag was this one doll. And that's Jasmine. Jasmine is quite the creepy doll. And I have no idea why it was in the deep freeze, but I'm sure the previous owner had a reason. Anyway, when I left that house, I went up to the attic and I drew like a weird pentagram on the floor in the attic, and I left a doll in the middle of it for the next person to find. So if they ever go up there, they'll be treated to something.
Yeah, I think Jasmine's so happy in my home because she's our spokesperson. She's the image on our t-shirt.
She's like the mascot.
She's sort of like the unofficial mascot of the dog museum. Yeah, so she loves it.
Ben shared what Kingstonians can expect from their visit.
Well, they can expect more dolls than they've ever seen in their entire lives. Kath are dressed up as two of the dolls. So the very first year, Catherine is a seamstress as well. And she picked out two of the dolls and made matching outfits for her and I. So we'll look smashing for sure. On the Saturday night, we will also have another living doll who will be working the crowd a little bit. What will be different about this year? So if there are people who are listening who have been before, and we have had people drive to the Peterborough show from Kingston, so you never know. There's always new dolls. And then this year, for the first time, we have created a diorama. And we have bags and bags of very small dolls that don't make it on display. And we've always, you know, felt kind of bad about these dolls that need their moment to shine. And so Catherine, myself, and two friends, Tim in Peterborough and Angie in Ottawa, have been working on a library scene. So it's a library diorama in the world of the creepy dolls. And we are very excited for that to show that off a little bit.
Yeah. We like to add a little something every year.
The museum's newest resident, Stephen, also dropped by to give a preview of what's to come. And will Stephen be joining you as well?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, definitely. I was writing his bio last night.
Would you like to give Kingstonians a little warning about Stephen since he's the newcomer?
Well, Stephen is a ventriloquist dummy from, I would guess, the 1890s based on the material he's built from. He was the prized possession of a circus performer. And in 1952, the Great Circus Fire, you know, burned down the circus tent. Every single patron perished in that fire. And the only thing that was found after the fire in the ash was Stephen holding a bag of 52 tongues.
Once again, that was Ben and Catherine with the Creepy Doll Museum coming to Kingston this weekend. For Brave Kingstonians, the Creepy Doll Museum will be open at the Broom Factory, 305 Rideau Street, on Friday, October 24th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. and Saturday, October 25th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. To learn more about the collection and their visit, you can check out at Creepy Doll Museum on Instagram. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, October 24th, high of 9 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud. Saturday, October 25th, it's going to be a cool day here in the city of Kingston. Still worth checking out the Queensgales versus McMaster Marauders playoff football game. Daytime high of 11 with a mix of sun and cloud. And then Sunday, October 26th, daytime high of 10, sunny conditions, but it'll feel closer to 11, dropping down to 7 overnight. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Aberdeen, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity. Albert, Princess 2 Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity. Barrie, Queen 2 Colborne is closed to accommodate construction activity. Barrie, Union 2 Bagot is closed October 20th to 24th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. for ongoing construction work. Earl Street, Collingwood 2 Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Johnson Street at Victoria is closed until October 24th for sewer separation and road rehabilitation. John Marks Avenue at Highway 15 is closed October 20th to 23rd from 7 to 7 to accommodate road works. Kings Court Ave, Concession, and First Ave is closed until November 21st for gas main installation. Sydenham Street, Princess 2 Queen is closed until October 24th for the Sydenham Street community space. Tivoli Avenue, Midland 2 Sierra is closed until October 24th for the installation of new services. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, delays for the installation of sanitary and water main utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 overhead structure. John Marks Avenue and Innovation Drive, delays while a contractor mobilizes to work on John Marks, Innovation Drive, and Discovery Avenue. Lancaster Drive, Limestone to Jasper. Contractor will be delaying things for the construction of new sidewalk and road. Montreal at John Counter, Trudell, Development to Danbury, and Victoria Street and Earl Street will all have delays due to construction work.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. The Great Lakes Museum is setting sail on a brand new Halloween adventure this weekend. For the first time ever, Kingston's own SS Keewaytin will transform into a haunted ship for Lock and Key, an interactive escape-style event happening Sunday, October 26th. The 1907 Edwardian steamship, older than the Titanic, is the perfect setting for a few ghostly surprises. Claire Notman, the museum's visitor experience manager, sat down with CFRC to share more about the event.
So on Sunday, October 26, we are having our very first Halloween event aboard the SS Keewaytin. So the Keewaytin arrived in Kingston last year. This is our second season with her. She is the last remaining Edwardian steam passenger liner in the world, built in 1907. So she's older than the Titanic, but of that era. And so as you can imagine, it is not very difficult to make something of that era a little bit creepy. If you kind of can imagine that era, the kind of that Downton Abbey Titanic era, you know, a few spider webs go a long way to making this this ship into kind of a spooky Halloween event space.
Visitors will explore the ship and solve puzzles to uncover a missing key that's keeping the captain from setting sail.
So we leaned right into the spooky season on the Keewaytin and at the museum. And so during the event, you can expect to travel through multiple spaces of the museum, this museum ship. It is kind of escape room themed, so you will have to take on several challenges in order to get the final solution, which is where these pesky spirits have hidden the key to the Keewaytin so the captain can then sail her on to the next port. So you will get to visit lots of different spaces in the ship that have been kind of spookified, the dining room, the lounge, some of the cabins. So expect some surprises.
And while Lock and Key leans into the Halloween spirit, some say the Keewaytin already has a few spirits of its own.
I have not myself had any spooky experiences on the ship. I have heard stories from, we have a fantastic crew of volunteer housekeepers who go onto the ship 3 days a week in the morning. I have heard from them, they've had some interesting things happen, you know, hearing voices when there's no one else on the ship sort of thing.
And for Notman, the idea was a natural fit.
This is my brainchild. I love Halloween. I love Halloween. I love escape rooms. And so I thought this was a perfect combination. We're very fortunate that we can keep the ship open a little bit later this season because the weather's been fairly good.
Lock and Key runs Sunday, October 26th with time slots between 3 and 8 p.m. Tickets are $13 per person with sweet treats offered at the end of the event. Costumes are encouraged and courage is required. The Haunted Walk also runs tours of the ship for those looking for more nautical nightmares this Halloween season. You can book your spot and learn more at greatlakesmuseum.ca. For the first time ever, researchers are studying whether non-hallucinogenic doses of psilocybin, the active compound found in psychedelic mushrooms, could help to treat generalized anxiety disorder. The Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute is leading this first-of-its-kind Health Canada-approved Phase 2A clinical trial. The trial will be testing the daily, at-home use of microdose psilocybin to see if it can safely ease anxiety symptoms without the trip. Generalized anxiety disorder affects about 5% of Canadian adults, more than 1.6 million people. And while it's common, many existing treatments can be slow to work or cause side effects that make long-term use difficult. Principal investigator of the study, Dr. Claudio Suarez, sat down with CFRC to tell us more about this first-of-its-kind clinical trial and what it could mean for the future of anxiety treatment. To start us off, I was wondering if you'd like to just introduce yourself for our listeners.
Well, my name is Claudio Suarez. I'm a psychiatrist here at Queen's University. I'm professor of psychiatry at Queen's. I'm also a clinician who sees patients in the medical and surgical floors from psychiatry. I work also in oncology and palliative care. And I do research. I'm the director of the Center for Psychedelics Health and Research at Providence Care, and also doing research in psychedelics here at KGH.
Great, thank you. And getting into our topic today, I was wondering if you could start us off by speaking to the gaps and challenges in current treatments that have kind of led to us turning to exploring these alternative methods.
For sure. So as you know, we have a lot of people suffering from depression and anxiety, like more kind of a clinical disabling anxiety, like 1 out of 6 Canadians have anxiety. And not everybody does well on medications, right? So we have psychotherapies that are quite effective for anxiety. But again, not everybody has access to psychotherapy and not everybody responded to psychotherapy. And the medications that we have are primarily antidepressants that we use for anxiety. Some patients responded well, but they can't tolerate side effects. They have, you know, weight gain or sexual dysfunction. So we're always looking for new treatments for anxiety to have another tool in our toolbox. And psychedelics are emerging as kind of promising treatments for anxiety. So that's why one of the things we're looking for is the use of a low dose or microdosing psychedelics. In this case, psilocybin for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the background and evidence so far, just where we're at with psilocybin specifically.
Sure. So psilocybin is the active ingredient of the magic mushrooms, right? So they have been used in like recreationally, but also in ritual and religious ceremonies for many, many, many years. And probably over the last 10 or 15 years, we're kind of experiencing like a renaissance in research on psychedelics. People are rediscovering psychedelics as potential medical treatments and trying to apply what we know about psychedelics for many years into the medical setting. So we see a lot of studies happening in psychedelics, particularly psilocybin, for depression, anxiety, to reduce cravings for alcohol in patients who have alcohol use disorder, and for PTSD as well. Although PTSD is more MDMA, that has been studied for that. But the psychedelics, Christina, in most studies, the predominant school of thoughts for psychedelics is to use what we call macrodoses, right? So people have a dose that induces changes in their perception of the environment, and perception of their selves. That's what we call the altered states of consciousness, or the trip. It's like people go through a hallucinogenic trip, which is it's the epiphenomenal. So there's a lot of things happening in your brain at the time that you do that. But that requires patients to come to a medical setting and use that medication and be under observation for at least 6 to 8 hours. So it's labor intensive. There are some more risks and side effects involved. The more recent school of thoughts were in parallel to that, we're looking at using psilocybin in lower doses that will not cause that whole experience of psychedelics from the hallucinogenic point of view, but we'll still have beneficial effects in your brain, maybe increasing neuroplasticity, maybe helping you to reduce the ruminative thoughts or the, you know, constant worrying that you have and anxiety. And they seem to work well. So there are some promising studies, but they have not been tested in a more kind of a, I would say, structured way. So that's the first study that we are aware of that's using microdosing delivered at home, to be used at home for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And again, you're talking about microdosing there and kind of getting into the nitty gritty. I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into what this means, either in practical or neurological terms, as opposed to, you know, going on a full macro dose and having those experiences.
For sure. So when we talk about macro dose or higher doses of psilocybin, usually we're talking about taking at least 25 or 30 milligrams of psilocybin, which then will induce that altered states of consciousness or, you know, what recreationally people call a trip, right? And that is probably the way or the mechanism by which psilocybin works in macro doses. So it's a boost of effects in at once that cause a cascade of reactions in your brain, increased neuroplasticity, and then opens that what we call more flexibility in your cognition to deal with anxiety. And that is done in combination with psychotherapy. So the notion is that you're using the macro dose to make it easier for patients to engage in psychotherapy and make it easier for them to be more cognitively flexible, to be more psychologically open to psychotherapy. When we're using microdosing, you're usually using a much lower dose, so it's between 1 to 3 milligrams. The sweet spot that we're trying to study is around 3 milligrams because it's just below the threshold for changing your brain from the hallucinogenic point of view. So at that dose, you're using the pharmacological effects of the psilocybin. So you're not inducing the hallucinogenic trips. You're not inducing changes in your perception. It's almost like using the same pathway that we use in antidepressants, but without having the side effects of the antidepressants. So the idea here is to use psilocybin more as a medicine as opposed to a catalyst for psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Because I think a lot of people, I think about psychedelic treatment as the experience of the trip is more so what's solving your issues or helping you work through it. But this sounds like it's more like those chemical changes in your brain, and that it's a bit different. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, and that's, you know, what you mentioned before, the psychedelic experience make it easier for you to do psychotherapy. This is probably the predominant classic way of thinking about psychedelics. And probably, I want to say 80 to 90% of the research on psychedelics so far has been focused on that way of delivering psychedelics. But we also know that psychedelics are neuroplastogens. So they change the brain plasticity, and they also have effects through serotonin in your brain, the same chemical that we use in antidepressants. So it's interacting with the same receptors that we use in medications, for instance, for depression and anxiety. So what we're looking at here is to benefit from, you know, slow doses or low dose of psilocybin delivered every day for a period of time, similar to what we do with other medications, but hopefully have a more enduring and less troubled from the side effect point of view that we have with antidepressants. So minimizing sexual dysfunction or weight gain or all the other side effects that sometimes are a major barrier for people to take medication for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And getting into this clinical trial, what's that going to kind of look like, and what makes it such a first in Canada?
So this is the first time that we're aware of that Health Canada has approved a study to allow us to give patients microdosing psilocybin to bring it home and take it home. So as you know, psilocybin is illegal, so you cannot or you should not go and buy psilocybin anywhere. So in order for you to do studies on psilocybin, we have to apply to a lot of regulatory bodies, including Health Canada, to get permission to obtain the psilocybin and store the psilocybin. So that has been done for other studies as well. But this study in particular allow us to then have a protocol in which patients come and try psilocybin for the first time in our hospital. They stay here for a few hours. We make sure that they don't have any unusual responses to psilocybin. And then they can take the medication at home. So they go home with a 1 week's worth of medication, and then they can use the medication at home. We monitor that very closely. And then they come every week to be reassessed up to 4 weeks. So it's a 4 week trial. And then people who responded well can stay for another 4 weeks when we then randomize them to be either on placebo or to remain on psilocybin. So that we're going to be looking at if they have any withdrawal symptoms or rebound anxiety after using for 4 weeks. So the total study is 8 weeks, but the first 4 weeks, everybody knows you're taking medication. And then the next 4 weeks, we split them between placebo and medication.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, what kind of outcomes are you measuring?
Yeah, so this is a phase two trial. So the clinical trials have different phases. So phase one usually is what we're looking at if the new medication is toxic or trying to find the right spot, so to speak, on the dosing. So that's how we end up with a 3 milligram dosing for this study. So this is a phase two trial. Phase two trials are usually small trials, like less than 100 patients. Well, we're trying to look at primarily safety and tolerability. So we're looking at if patients have any side effects. We check their blood work to see if their, you know, kidneys are working well, their liver, their heart, to make sure that everything is okay prior to, but also make sure the medication doesn't impact their health in general. But we also collect some data on efficacy. So we look at scales for anxiety, measure their anxiety, their self-perception of anxiety, how well they are functioning at home or work or at school. So there are a few measures that we use to look at success. And that study will inform, hopefully, a phase three trials. For phase three are larger trials, more like what we see when we're applying for new medications to Health Canada or FDA. We have to use a phase three trial. So these are larger trials. But this trial that we're doing will inform the next one if everything goes well.
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to ask you, just as a clinician and as a scientist, what excites you about diving into this research?
Well, so when I got involved with psychedelic research probably close to 3 or 4 years ago, when Queen's decided to put together an advisory board to look at psychedelic medicine. And I came from the field on psychiatry, mood disorders, but also see patients in oncology. So I was aware of the major gaps that we have in the treatments that we have for depression, anxiety, but also PTSD and oncology. A lot of patients with late stage cancer have what we call existential distress, and that really doesn't respond well to medication. And psychedelics have emerged in the last few years as a promising option for many of those patients. But there are not a lot of clinical trials happening in Canada. And I became fascinated with some of the options. And I saw and I've seen, I did a long training in US, close to 1 year on psychedelic research. And I've seen both patients and participants, but also videos with dramatic changes very quickly. So I became quite fascinated by the promising effects, but also very aware that psychedelic research comes with a lot of stigma, a lot of mistrust and misinformation. So getting involved in research, but also helping to destigmatize psychedelics and find the right population that can use, it became one of the areas that I'm quite interested in. So we created a center for psychedelics at Providence Care. We opened last year, and we're doing research both at Providence Care, but also at KGH as well.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hoping this means for the future of care in this area?
So I think if we can learn when and how psychedelics can be helpful, that will inform probably in a better way how can we use psychedelics in the medical setting versus recreational, which is one of the challenges with cannabis, for instance. Right? When cannabis became legalized, the research on cannabis suffered because a lot of the medical cannabis research became very difficult to conduct studies because people just go across the street and buy what they think they're buying, right, in terms of concentration and use. So what we're trying to do is to avoid that we make some of the mistakes that we made with cannabis in general, that we understand how psychedelics can be used safely for medical purpose. So then if or when psychedelics become legalized, we can clearly differentiate what is psychedelic use for medical practice versus psychedelics for recreation.
And just to wrap us up here, who can take part in this study and how can people get involved or learn more?
Yeah, so people can reach out to us. So they can look at, you know, CS Research at queensu.ca, but they can also reach out to KJSC or the Center for Psychedelics at Providence Care. What we're looking for this particular study are anyone ages 18 to 60 whose primary diagnosis is anxiety. Either they were diagnosed with anxiety by their GP or their primary care or psychiatrist, or they were medicated for anxiety in the past, and they're having right now anxiety that's really affecting their ability to function, like constant worries or concerns, inability to function due to anxiety. They cannot be suffering from major depression or psychosis or alcohol use disorder, but we will screen them. We will have an assessment, and if they qualify, they can come to the study. We do a series of medical assessments to make sure they are healthy otherwise, and then they can join the study.
Once again, that was Dr. Claudia Suarez, who will be leading a first-of-its-kind study on the use of psychedelics to treat generalized anxiety disorder at the Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute. As one of the largest mental health research trials currently underway at KHSC, the study represents an important step in advancing evidence-based innovation in psychiatric care. As Dr. Suarez mentioned, researchers are currently seeking adults living with generalized anxiety disorder to join the study. To learn more or inquire about participation, you can contact the research team by email at cs.research@queensu.ca. After a tight race with over 1,600 votes cast, the city of Kingston has crowned not one, but two official city birds. The city invited residents to help choose the bird that best represents Kingston's spirit, part of its bid to become a Nature Canada certified bird-friendly city in 2025. A shortlist of 15 local species was chosen by the bird-friendly city team. However, keen-eyed Kingstonians noticed that one feathered resident was missing from the flock. Karen Santucci, Director of Public Works and Solid Waste with the city, described the eventful race.
We started this contest as part of an application we put in to become a bird-friendly city. So as one of the elements of that, it is to choose a city bird. So we started the contest. We started out with, we have a bird team that we work with. And the bird team consists of a number of people from different organizations involved with birds and other similar types of things. So our team came up with a list of 15 birds. We chose from all different types, water birds, songbirds, shore birds, nocturnal birds, birds of prey. So we chose from some from every different area. And so we had 15. And then we had a huge outcry from the crow community. So in Kingston, there is a huge following of the crow community. So we added the crow.
Kingstonians flocked to the polls, and in the end, both the crow and the cardinal soared to the top, tying with 339 votes each. The pair will now share the perch as Kingston's official city birds.
It was a really tight race all the way through between the cardinal and the crow. It was hilarious to see. There was crow community was definitely involved. There was signs put up downtown, vote crow. And when it came down to it, it was 339 votes for the cardinal and 339 votes for the crow. So we've called them both the city bird. They're actually very interesting birds. They both stay all year. The crow is a very community-oriented birds, very intelligent birds. They flock together, especially in the winter. You'll see huge flocks of thousands of crows together. Cardinal's a little bit more of a solitary bird with just a few people in their community, but definitely, again, another bird that stays all year. So excellent birds to represent the city.
The winners were announced at the city's World Migratory Bird Day celebrations over the weekend. One more step in Kingston's journey towards becoming an officially bird-friendly city.
So we had two different events, one which was the Kingston Fall Birding Festival in Doug Fleur Park, and the other one which was a hedgerow habitat workshop that was happening in the West End. Both of these were happening on the same day because it was Fall Migratory Bird Day. So this is the peak time where we see migratory birds heading south. So it is a global migratory bird day. So it was planned specifically around that event. The one for the hedgerows was sold out. They actually got a grant from birds from Bird Friendly Cities for that to supply some supplies for people to plant hedgerows. And then the Kingston Fall Birding Festival was downtown. There was a great turnout out there. I was there. Lots of people from Kingston Field Naturalists. Lots of people showed up from the community where people from Kingston Field Naturalists were letting them use some of their equipment, see the birds, explain what was there. Lots of kids, lots of older adults, lots of people new to Canada, new to Kingston. So it was a really neat mix of people. Everyone gathered. They were all quite excited to hear that there was two birds, the crow and the cardinal. So I think it went over really well. Everyone was quite happy to hear the combination of birds that had been chosen.
As the city continues to spread its wings in promoting bird conservation, residents can expect more initiatives taking flight, protecting and celebrating the birds that call Kingston home.
Yep. So in terms of Bird Friendly City, our application has gone in. Over the last 50 years, there's been a loss of about 3 billion birds. And so Bird Friendly Cities is a program to help reverse the trend through some coordination, some science-backed information and some local action. So it's really about what can we do to reduce the threats to birds? How do we protect and restore nature's natural habitats? How do we engage and communicate to communities? And how do we celebrate urban bird life? So taking a look at all of those, there's lots of different pieces that went into it. Our application was about 79-80 pages long. So lots of information that we have on terms of things that we're doing around birds, lots of things that we can still do to improve going forward. So we're trying to enter at an entry level. There's also an intermediate level and an advanced level. So lots of room for us to improve over the upcoming years as well. We've got a draft of a bird-friendly city webpage coming to the city's website. So hopefully up within the next month or so, people will be able to go in, learn more about bird-friendly cities, learn more about what they can do to help support bird habitats as well. So that will be coming, and there'll be some social media that goes out around that to let people know that that page is up and running, and there's information that all the residents could use from there.
And with such a strong community response, Kingston seems well on its way to earning its bird-friendly wings.
Lots of twists and turns along the way. We were watching it pretty closely. It was a fun race to watch on a daily basis. Excellent turnouts for this competition. So it was fun to see.
So with Halloween just around the corner, if you spot a flash of red or a full-on murder overhead, don't worry. It's just Kingston's newest celebrity species. Baseball fever is hitting Kingston as the Toronto Blue Jays head into the World Series for the first time in 32 years, and the city is inviting fans to celebrate together in Springer Market Square. Starting Friday, October 24th, each World Series game will be shown live on the big inflatable screen downtown. Fans are encouraged to throw on their Blue Jays gear, grab some friends, and cheer on the team under the Kingston night sky. Games start at 8 p.m. and watch parties will run rain or shine. Just be sure to dress for the weather and bring along a blanket or umbrella. The full series runs October 24th, 25th, 27th, 28th, 29th, 31st, and November 1st. For weather updates or announcements, check the City of Kingston's social media before game time. While official Queen's University homecoming celebrations took place last weekend, the City of Kingston is preparing for unofficial FOCO festivities expected across the university district this weekend. The city is reminding everyone to celebrate safely, respectfully, and responsibly. The University District Safety Initiative remains in effect, with increased police and bylaw enforcement throughout the area. Large unsanctioned gatherings may lead to significant fines under the nuisance party bylaw. That's up to $2,000 for hosting or $500 for failing to comply with an order to leave. To help keep everyone safe, Breakwater Park and Gord Edgar Downey Pier will also close nightly from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. this weekend. The city encourages residents and visitors alike to enjoy the weekend while respecting Kingston's neighborhoods and community. For more information and ongoing updates, visit cityofkingston.ca or follow the city on social media. Before we wrap up this morning, we're going to run through your Friday forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer this weekend. Starting off tonight, as you heard earlier in this episode, the Creepy Doll Museum is bringing nearly 200 dolls, some haunted, some just unsettling, to the Broom Factory at 6:30 p.m. tonight. Over at Queen's, check out Who Owns Our Knowledge, a practical guide to open access. That's at 1 p.m. in Stauffer Library. For a laugh, catch Bored Teachers' The Struggle is Real comedy tour at the Kingston Grand Theatre at 7:30 p.m. tonight. Or get into the spooky spirit at Fort Fright, running nightly at 7 p.m. through November 1st. If live music's more your vibe tonight, Brownman's Halloween Thriller hits the RCHA at 7 p.m. While Sleep on the Couch, Doghouse, and Two Time take the stage at the Mansion at 8:30 p.m. You can also catch Candlelight, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and the ABBA Tribute Double Feature at the Spire or Super Nintendo over at Musiki Cafe at 8 p.m. Tomorrow on Saturday, October 25th, once again, the Creepy Doll Museum continues at the Broom Factory at 5 p.m. And the Masquerade Gala gets underway at Our Lady of Fatima Parish at 5:30 p.m. The Kingston Public Market is open in Springer Market Square from 8:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. And if you're up late, there's karaoke at Time Out starting at 9 p.m. Saturday's concert lineup is packed. Highlights include Tom Morello live at the Kingston Grand at 7:30 p.m., Big Fat Horn Band at RCHA, and Craig Cardiff bringing his folk tunes to Musiki at 5:30 p.m. Then wrapping up the weekend on Sunday, October 26th, you can take in the Canadian Songbook Tribute Show at the Broom Factory at 2:30 p.m., or classical fans can enjoy Mozart and Schubert at the Isabel at the same time. Plus, the Wild Art Walk continues all week long at Milburn Creek Nature Reserve. Perfect for a crisp fall stroll. Once again, that's your Friday forecast. For full event details and even more live shows around town, you can check out CFRC's community events calendar anytime at cfrc.ca. Have an event or concert you'd like to add to our online and on-air calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca. And don't forget to follow CFRC on Instagram at cfrcmusic. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office and supported by our friends at Modern City Taxi, we're pleased to present a selection from Cassador 2, the latest EP from Kingston rockers Cassador. The new EP takes an introspective look into feeling human in the modern day and age, set to an authentic presentation of live performed rock music. The EP preceding a new album dropping this winter is a truly local package of talent, featuring writing and performances by Julia Finnegan, Brett Emmons, Namby, and Justin Rutledge. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Cassador 2 by Cassador on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Trouble, right here now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Favorite art.